You're listening to the Cannabis Investing Network. Before we begin, a short disclaimer. The full disclaimer follows at the end of this episode. This podcast is a general communication and is being provided for entertainment and information purposes only. It is educational in nature and is not designed to be a recommendation for any specific investment strategy, plan, feature, or other purpose. Please enjoy responsibly. Hello and welcome back to the Cannabis Investing Network podcast. My name is Manish, and oh, do we have a fun one for everybody today. Joining us, the Managing Director at Sharp Capital Advisors. His name is Colin Campbell. Colin, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So Colin, what I like about Sharp Capital Advisors, when you go on your website, it says right there on the front page, we help cannabis companies do M&A. You guys are exclusive advisors to the cannabis industry. Is that right?
That's right. We tried to really lean into the space, and we think that there's a level of authenticity that comes with that. We're focused on the entire supply chain and all of the ancillaries that exist in and around the cannabis ecosystem. I think there's a lot of complexity in the industry. I think it's incredibly unique and exciting. And so I think really spending all of our time and our energy in this particular space gives us a good perspective and I think a good feel for what's going on.
Yeah, well, I would say if you spend all of your time and energy in this space, then there probably aren't many good feels, especially lately, right? But I do love that, you know, you guys are dedicated to the industry. And before we start, I want to give a shout out to Rebecca and Steve from your team who keep in touch and I've actually got introduced to just from operators in the space. So look, it's going to be a really fun one today because I want to talk about what you're seeing out there, what it's like to be out on the street raising capital for cannabis, how it's changed over the last 2 years. I know you've had some recent success as well that I want to chat about. And really, I want to spend a lot of time talking about the intersection of cannabis and technology, or Cannatech as we call it. And then lastly, I want to talk about capital markets and, you know, potential TSX uplisting and what that could mean for the space.
Oh, Manish, so much ground to cover, so many ideas, so many thoughts. I will absolutely follow your lead, but I think we've got a lot of ground to cover.
Right on. So just to kick it off, how is it out there, right? What does it mean? Talk a little bit about Sharp. Like, what does it mean to be a company who's exclusively focused on the cannabis industry trying to raise capital? Like, what is that like these days?
Yeah, I mean, look, our DNA, our track record had always been at other firms, traditional middle market M&A. And in that case, capital raising is important, but maybe not necessarily the main line of service. And what we quickly realized when we really began dedicating ourselves to this industry is that the M&A piece will come and there's a time for that, but it's going to go through these market cycles like every other industry, but almost maybe more so in this one, just the swing. And that capital raising is such a critical component to this fledgling industry as it's trying to really get up off the ground and become more mature, more sophisticated. And so over the last few years, we've seen capital sources become increasingly sophisticated and increasingly critical as the broader capital markets have changed. And you see trends across industries that make on a risk-adjusted view of the various industries pretty interesting. Right. And all of a sudden there's opportunities where there wasn't some before. So we've seen an overall trend in how capital gets raised, the level of sophistication of both the operators and the capital providers and what that conversation looks like. And I'll tell you that I think a lot of the capital, probably to no one's shock, a lot of the capital that was raised a couple years ago couldn't get done today. Partly because of just the cost of capital has moved, partly because I think people have a different view of the industry and the investment thesis. And so I think you have to be sort of boots on the ground. You have to be living and breathing the industry. And honestly, it does give us good feels. Not every day is a great day, but it does give us good feels to see that there are good companies. There are still good investors. There is some capital to be had out there. And we're all very bullish and optimistic that the industry will survive through this. Good companies will survive through this, and the capital markets will become more favorable to the industry here, hopefully in the not too distant future as well.
Okay, so let's just pull on what you're saying here with this, you know, this optimism, this bullishness, which, listen, if some of that could rub off on me, I would be very glad, trust me. But but when it comes to capital raising, and you're talking about the sophistication of investors, what are investors asking these days? Like, is all the focus on the balance sheet and cash flow, or like what has been the most dramatic change over the last 2 years?
Well, so broadly, yes, right? The focus on the balance sheet and the cash flow is more acute now than it typically had been. I think that there was this sense a couple years ago that everything was going to be up and to the right. The projections we would get from companies were these almost cliched hockey stick shaped numbers. Sure. And it's a little hard to digest coming from other industries and then looking at this and thinking this is the norm. But it was, in fact, the norm. And I think in many cases, but for maybe some regulatory headwinds, maybe the lack of regulation of the illicit market, you know, I think many of those companies would have, in fact, performed according to those projections. And I think you look now, you know, there's some court cases going on right now. And companies are having to defend projections that they had come out with years ago. And I think at that time, I think it's safe to say that that was, based on the information they had at hand, those were probably as good as anybody else's projections. I think now the capital community is looking at it with a little grain of salt and a different perspective. I think even as recent as Q4 of last year, with the hope that SAFE was yet again going to get passed ultimately, you know, I think that kind of kept hopes alive. Mm-hmm. And I mean, finally, now we're all hopefully dealing with the reality that you can't build a business on the hope that the federal government does something according to a set timeline. And we have to deal with the realities of today. And so I think capital and operators are increasingly looking at, you know, are we building a business that's going to survive the next 12 to 24 months? Or are we building a business that's built to thrive beyond the 24 months? And ideally, you'd have a company that could do both. But I think the challenge is that many companies are building for that longer term view without the reality of how do you survive in the near term.
Right. Okay. So let's delve into this a little bit. So the longer term view, what does that look like in your mind? And how do you balance that with the short term, right? So when we talk about, you know, MSOs and limited license states, which of the two is that? Is that extracting more value up front, or is that more of a long-term sustainable business? How do you view it?
I think it's more extracting value up front. I mean, as much, so I live in Southern California. Mm-hmm. I have a soft spot in my heart for the California market, despite all of its eccentricities and challenges. And so, you know, someone called me out the other day and they said, you know, you throw a lot of shade at MSOs sitting in their limited license states. But the reality is that if I were in their position, I would probably be doing the same thing.
Okay.
And I've had conversations with MSOs, and the recurring comment had been, California is a knife fight. Mm-hmm. And so see some of them pull out of the state, I'm not shocked. And you look at their balance sheets and you look at their cash flow and you think, if you turn off, you know, $150 million of CapEx annually, all of a sudden, those companies start to cash flow incredibly well. And so I think their timing is actually pretty good. I think the strategy is pretty good. But are they building a business with verticality in multiple states that's going to be efficient and the same model you're going to want, you know, once legalization ultimately occurs? No. And so that's where I think it's interesting when you start looking at some of those bigger players, and there's a different strategy where some are buying the real estate, buying the underlying assets, because they'll be able to monetize them down the track, versus others who are signing up to long-term lease obligations. You know, that I think will ultimately come home to roost at some point for those guys in the next 5 to 10 years.
Okay, so that's really interesting. So I like how you're approaching it there. And I take your point that at the end of the day, a limited license market with high prices, that's got a limited shelf life on it, right? And ultimately those prices correct. We've all seen that. We lived through that. Very painful. right? You alluded to the fact that you're still bullish. There are investors that are still bullish. So what are they bullish on, right? If people have caught on that, hey, limited license is short term, then what is it that get these investors excited when they're thinking about the long term?
So look at the consumption rate, even in a mature state like California, right? Okay. Of cannabis versus alcohol. I think ultimately, and there's been, you know, we can debate the merits of some of the studies, but if we at least buy into the thesis that cannabis ultimately becomes a substitute for other activities, then there is a cannibalization piece there. If you start looking at penetration rates within states of cannabis versus other things like alcohol, it would imply that there is a tremendous amount of opportunity as more consumers come into the cannabis market. And even in some of the Western states where you see that the top line sales has come down, when you affect that for the decreased cost of flower, the reality is that in many cases, I think maybe most or if not all cases, the transaction numbers are actually going up.
Totally.
So you're seeing this underlying movement towards a mainstreaming of the industry. And I think anecdotally, I mean, I have friends and colleagues and we're all parents and we talk about how our kids are going to grow up in a world where cannabis is legal and it's just a normal alternative. Mm-hmm. And I think that is what the capital community is getting bullish about. And that's where you look at the caliber of capital that's being deployed right now. So we went through a phase for a couple of years where it was really driven by institutional cannabis investors. Now, the reality is that because of all of the federal regulatory overhang, most of that capital behind them was really high net worth family office, my suspicions, right? But I think what you're seeing now is that the reason why, from an investment banking standpoint, I like that capital is because it can be so patient, right? They can sit and hold a position for 5 years, 10 years, longer. I've had couple conversations with family offices and their strategy is to never sell. So they are the epitome of patient capital. They don't need to wait for federal legalization or interstate commerce. However, they're also not foolish capital. And I think they're looking at where their businesses that can actually generate cash flow and generate returns, even in a very difficult and complicated market like we have today. So that's the capital that you see getting done. And that's where it's not necessarily the institutional capital that's driving it right now. Now, that being said, right, and I think you started to allude to this. Now, we were very fortunate in that we were able to help a company called Green Check Verified, which I think hands down is the leading fintech, regtech solution in the space with their recent round of capital raise. And there again, I think it's interesting when you start looking at opportunities that are not plant touching, that but for the fact that they participate in an industry that's growing at a double digit CAGR, there is no 280E overhang, right? There is no issues with interstate commerce for them because for them, as an example, their customers are financial institutions. They're solving one of the biggest issues that the industry has, which is compliant banking. And they're enabling financial institutions to come in and service an industry that desperately needs those services. So there's an example where not only can you benefit from a patient capital viewpoint, but you can also benefit from a business model that doesn't have some of the same headwinds while yet participating in an industry that's growing at this double-digit CAGR. I mean, I think by most every estimate, you know, we're seeing that the cannabis industry in the U.S. will be north of $50 billion in the not-too-distant future. So the investment thesis is there. The capital just has to be have the right patience.
So I want to expand on what you're saying there, right? Because you're one of my favorite topics to talk about is this idea of Canatech. Right, this asset class that is not subject to 280E has the ability to scale like technology has scaled and can maybe attract technology investors. Although, you know, right now they're maybe not doing so well in general, there still is a lot of capital out there behind technology. So going to what you're talking about, you know, one of the interesting things is to see if you look at California, if you look at Canada, there has been significant normalization around cannabis. That's great. There has been tremendous price compression, which has been very painful. But on the bright side, you know, that has helped the volume increase. And it seems, you would think at least, it's pulling from the illicit market. In Canada especially, I think it has the lowering of prices and how ubiquitous kind of cheap quality cannabis is has definitely helped tamp down the illicit market. So when we think about this industry that's generating, you know, tens of billions of dollars of sales, the operators, you know, because of 280E and competition, maybe aren't making money. But at the end of the day, maybe there is this subsector of companies in the technology space that are able to make money, right? And are able to capture, you know, a portion of that, those sales figures, right? So that's an area I've always been fascinated by. I've done a couple of private deals in that space, relatively small. Green Check Verified, which you're talking about, was actually one of them. And I've been an investor in that for a few years, small investor. So I was very happy to see the raise you guys did. Let's talk about Canatech, right? The intersection of cannabis companies and technology companies. This is a space that I think you have a good amount of experience in. What is the appetite? How does this space differ from cannabis operators and more vanilla technology companies? Like, talk to us a little bit about that.
So my thesis a couple of years ago, coming from our affiliated company, Livingstone Partners. So my background had been business and technology services businesses. And I raised my hand and I said, I think we need to go cover the sector because all of the industry tailwinds are going in one direction. This is going to be increasingly mainstreamed and legalized. I just can't tell you when. Mm-hmm. And I looked at it and I thought, most of the traditional private equity and venture capital play, they're going to want to be able to participate in the industry, but not necessarily from a plant-touching standpoint. And in fact, as I was rolling off of a couple tech deals into the cannabis space, and I was telling the private equity contacts in my community, hey, I'm going to be doing this thing, every single one of them said the same thing. We get it. We love it. We're coming. Yep, totally makes sense. We're going to want to see the tech stuff. We're going to want to see the business services stuff. We're going to, the cliche, you know, picks and axes to the miners, right? We're going to be the ones selling the support, the ancillary services.
Sure.
And there was actually five that specifically said, we are building special purpose vehicles with a curated list of LPs that will allow us to go in and participate in these emerging industries. And at the time, that was kind of the euphemism, the code. Now, that was a couple years ago, coming up on almost 3 years ago. Yeah. When we recently went out to market, I talked to a lot of those same folks. And their response was, we love it. We get it. This is exactly where we want to be. We're probably 6 to 12 months away. And I'm saying, you've been 6 to 12 months away for the last 3 years.
I was going to say, it seems like they're always 6 to 12 months away.
They're always 6 to 12 months away. I think the challenge was last year, just the broader capital markets pulling back.
Sure.
Right. Yeah. And then what that meant is that on a risk-adjusted basis, the cannabis opportunities didn't look quite as good. The Canatech opportunities, I think, are particularly interesting because they've got the scalability, because the story resonates with the investors and the LPs. They get the concept of MRR and ARR, right? They get the concept of how scalable and high margin that can be. And they...
Can you just explain that?
Sure. So MRR, monthly recurring revenue, or ARR is annual recurring revenue, concept being that for most of these, particularly SaaS type platforms, software as a service, it's really built on a subscription model. And so there's oftentimes in a traditional tech model, there's a significant amount of CapEx and development that goes into the early stages. And that's where in the heyday of technology, you would see these incredibly massive raises with companies that are just burning cash. But the idea would be that they would get enough subscribers onto the platform. They would capture enough of the market and a lot of that spend would turn off. And then all of a sudden, that subscription base became a very high margin business and more than made up for the initial cash burn. And that's where back in the day, you sort of had the genesis of some of the big tech companies that we see today. That's a very simplified version, but that's the principle behind some of the SaaS and technology models. And we see some of those models today.
And it's fascinating, you know, when you look at a SaaS deal, it's like you have to learn a whole new vocabulary, right? Probably similar to if people have never, you know, the first time looking at a cannabis deal, right? They have to learn all these new terms and everything. And that's what I found with doing a SaaS deal, right? You have to talk about, you know, ARR and, you know, customer acquisition cost. And, you know, I think people now look a lot more at burn rate. But to your point, because it's so lucrative, once you get people on this monthly recurring revenue, they're willing to, first of all, A, spend a ton of money in the build out, right? But then also spend money in the customer acquisition and then burn money all the way with in the hopes that one day you'll hit scale and you'll hit the tipping point and you'll suddenly be able to print cash flow because now your revenue line has greatly increased and you can even scale back on your acquisition cost.
Correct. Correct. And there's a couple other key metrics too that I think you'd want to be thinking about, right? What's the lifetime value of that client? And that's sort of the offset to that client acquisition cost, right? And that gets very interesting when you start looking at some of the subscription models. But the challenge here is, and this is, I think, what wasn't fully appreciated by some of the tech community and the Canatech community going into 2022, is that the same challenges and headwinds that we see facing plant-touching businesses, particularly at the retail end, well, really all through the supply chain, is that ultimately, who are these Canatech companies trying to sign up? Who is their customer? And in many cases, it's the operators, it's the businesses, right? And so they're equally cash constrained, and they're feeling some of that same pushback, and maybe not finding the scale that they initially thought they would. And so I think just as we saw many companies go public in, I think, pursuit of easy capital, we can look at, there's a lot of companies that honestly today, if I think we were candid with one another, have no business being public. And that's true of plant touching companies and not. And I think what the challenge is that they're facing, the scale didn't come. And I think some of the tech companies now are realizing that the scale hasn't come to them either, largely because of all of the other industry headwinds. And tech wasn't necessarily going to be a solve to find their way out of it. So that's where I'll flag a couple things for you, then we can kind of go where you want, right? Companies like POS stations, so point of sales services, right? The illicit market doesn't use that. They don't need that. So you're really only going after the legal operators. And it's a function that they have to have, but it's difficult. How do you differentiate your POS from another, but for how it integrates with the rest of the tech ecosystem? And then we take that and we look at, well, what's the ultimate play there? Because there are other mainstreamed POS systems that, what's preventing them from coming into the space, but for federal regulatory intervention or action? Well, once that wall comes down, do these companies have a longer term lifespan? What's their exit? And so I think that's kind of interesting. So with that thought in mind, you know, we can sort of compare. You've got technology like POS and payments. You've got technology, which I call more reg tech, which is kind of a green check, sort of a mission critical component and infrastructure. And then you have other pieces, which is more of an e-com or even a MarTech, marketing technology element. And I think each of those is kind of interesting in its own way and all have very mainstreamed models and examples that work. But the question is, which is going to work in this particular industry? And I think right now it's that fintech, regtech position that probably has the most tailwinds behind it, largely because whether you're in cannabis or not, I think everybody would just inherently recognize, man, there's a lot of regulatory complexity here, and to mess up and fall afoul of some government agency somewhere and jeopardize your license or your customers or your profitability could be a death knell to a business in an already difficult environment.
So an example of regulatory technology would be like maybe like Metric, like something that's seed to sale tracking. You know, you have to use it, it's government mandated.
So that's an interesting run, right? Because it is government mandated. And so they've got an interesting space in the market where customers sort of have to use them. And Metrics, unfortunately, fallen victim to some bad press earlier this year, that, you know, what happens when customers can't pay Metric? Now, I think in reality, that ended up being a false claim, and that really wasn't an issue, but it kind of makes the case, right? You've got operators in the space who are already challenged on margin, and you have government forcing them to pay for a service. Now, the reality is, I think we'd all probably agree, it's the right service, right? At the end of the day, we all want customers to be safe and know that they're dealing with legal, compliant, tested product that's not going to make anybody sick or get anybody hurt. Sure. So I think that's an important part of the infrastructure. But beyond that, you have other RegTech and plays like Simplifya, for example, right? Which I think is kind of interesting. And I'll say right now, any of the companies I mentioned today, I have no relationship with any of them. So these are just observations from sort of being in the market. Yeah. But Simplifya, I think, is a really interesting one where they've tried to create a solution to help operators really understand what is the on-site regulatory and compliant requirements that they have to adhere to. And they'll go so far as to do an audit and make sure that an operator is compliant and has all of their pieces in order. And then they built technology on the back of that to make sure that they're storing all of their documentation correctly and have it if they ever were to get checked, right? So it's not, in Metric is kind of the big obvious one, but there's all of these other components all the way through the supply chain, because the reality is that every piece of this operation is scrutinized and falls to some form of regulatory oversight.
So let me ask you, you mentioned MarTech, right? Marketing technology. So Weedmaps would be a fair example of this, right? It's a technology that exists to basically help dispensaries in their marketing efforts.
Correct. Yeah.
So here's what I want to discuss with you, right? So we look at a company like Weedmaps, which I've looked at many times, you know, with a SPAC, right? It's down, you know, over 90%, which is not uncommon for SPACs. It's a company that has pretty good scale, right? It's in many states, big in California. And I take your point, right? It's hard for a company or a line of business to do well if their customers are going broke, right? We learned that in the early days of Canadian cannabis, where you had these extractors who were posting great results, but then on the other hand, their customers were posting very bad results. And ultimately, over time, it caught up to them. So let's talk about, you know, Weedmaps, for example, and I don't know how much you're allowed to say, but I want to just use that as an example of, there's a company that is public, right? People can purchase, has weed right in the name, right? Probably has some brand recognition, you know, amongst investors, retail investors, and people on the street. And yet, not getting a lot of love out there, right? Trading at a relatively low market cap, you know, probably because of the cash burn and other issues that they're having. I guess what I'm getting at is that even a company that seems to have a lot of things figured out, has scale and is public, not really attracting a lot of investor love.
It's true, right? I mean, like $215 million of revenue in a TTM basis. I think this is as of December. But EBITDA was a minus 44, mm-hmm. right? Net income's a minus 116. And that's not on the back of real heavy CapEx. I mean, it was $16 million last year in CapEx. So here's a tech company that, to your point, is trading at less than 1x revenue on an enterprise value basis. Mm-hmm. It's one of those examples where this feels like this should be a good buying opportunity. The question is, though, how patient can that capital be? Mm. Right? Ultimately, does someone like this win and turn around? Yes, I think probably so. But the question is when. And I think the challenge in the public markets, and this is why I made the comment earlier, I think there's so many companies that probably don't have any business being public. I'm not saying this is one of them, but I'm saying there are challenges to being public. And one of that is you have to post, you have to share your financial results. And you have to talk to analysts, and you have to provide typically some form of guidance. And I think the individual investor, the retail investor, oftentimes has a much shorter time horizon. In a prior career, I was on a team we managed about It was $750 million in assets under management on a high net worth private wealth management team. And we continually had this debate, right? It's a matter for a retail investor. What is your risk tolerance? What is your time horizon? How do you think about allocating capital across various industries and sectors? And this is one where I think the challenge is that we don't know what the time horizon of our industry and this maturation curve is going to look like. And really, that's the challenge, right? I think there's nothing fundamentally wrong with weed maps or a number of the other big tech plays. I think that's where you see Akerna leaving the industry and selling their cannabis assets and merging with a Bitcoin mining company, right? I think they've thrown in the towel largely because the fatigue level is high. And that's true not just of plant touching companies, but even some of the cannatech companies. And I think that's where you see, again, the patient capital coming in because they can buy into the larger thesis that retail investors oftentimes just don't have the stomach for.
Let's talk about that because, you know, you mentioned patient capital, right? And the ability to wait. I think if you could say to most retail investors today who are in cannabis, right? Like in MSOs, plant touching operators, whatever. If you could just say, look, if you can just wait this out, right? Let it be 5 years, 10 years, whatever the amount of time is. And this will be okay. This will recover. This will do well. I think it's easier to say it than do it, but I think that it would go, okay, cool. Like, you know, there's a light at the end of the tunnel. We'll get through this, right? And just going back to this weed maps example, I think what concerns people is this idea of, you know, if a company's burning cash and, you know, the stock is in the toilet and it's you know, very dilutive to raise, it's not just a matter of being patient, right? It's like, hey, this, you know, our cash is a melting ice cube. And if it melts out, it goes to zero, right? So either, you know, we have a risk of going to zero or we have a risk of extraordinarily dilutive or punitive financing, which punishes our equity value. So, you know, in your seat, when you're looking at capital raising, like how do you look at scenarios like that, right? Because if you're dealing with tech, you are dealing typically with cash burning companies.
In most cases, yes, right? Now let's talk about weed maps for just a second. So sure. Cash from operations over the last 12 months, this is as of December, was a minus $11 million.
Pretty good. Pretty amazing actually for our industry and the size and scale they have.
Right. Right now, 12-month TTM cash from ops as of December 2021, a positive $30 million.
Yeah, that's not good.
No, that is good.
No, I mean the change, the delta.
Well, the delta is not good. No, the delta is not good. But in the light of everything else, I think that's still pretty compelling relative to some of the other companies that we see, right? So $11 million to the negative of cash from ops. Let me do a quick calc here. Levered cash flow, levered free cash flow on that business, same time period, minus $3.7 million. So in reality, they're not burning that much cash. And then you go to the balance sheet, and I think we're talking about $28 million in cash on the balance sheet. Mm-hmm. So actually, you look at that and you go, well, that company is doing fine, right? They've got runway. And this is where now I put my distressed hat on, which for anybody who's seen some of my postings and musings, you know that I can go down this rabbit hole. A lot of conversations these days are about burn rate and runway. And I think that becomes a challenge. The difference is, again, in the traditional tech market, it was almost growth at any cost. Right. Mm-hmm. And that was a philosophy that I think cannabis largely held true. This is, you know, going back now, well, prior to 2022, safe to say. Sure. And in many cases, I think there's operators that still hold that to be true. And the challenge is that's just not the case anymore. And so it has to be growth at reasonable rates, growth at reasonable cost. But the challenge, again, to our industry, cost of capital is so high. Senior secured debt capital for plant-touching companies right now, backed by commercial real estate. I mean, I'm seeing prices in the high teens, low 20s, and in many cases, that's before some sort of warrant or equity kicker to juice it even further. But you can't have companies raising capital at those costs where their cash flow is negative, cash from ops is negative, or at least even flat, and then try and service that kind of debt.
Sure.
So the capital markets are punishing the businesses just as much as the actual industry headwinds are.
You know, is it the tail wagging the dog or the dog wagging the tail, right? I mean, the capital markets are a forward discounting mechanism, and they're seeing, I mean, two things, right? They're seeing better alternatives out there, and they're seeing a lot of uncertainty about where is this thing going, right? So just to kind of come back to Weedmaps as an example, like on the cash flow statement, you know, they burned $11 million for the year, which you go, hey, that's not bad at all, right? That's actually pretty good for, especially for tech and especially for our industry. But then, you know, you have these kind of things, like you have another $10 million burned on distributions and repayment of insurance premium financing, right? Under the line. Like, what is that, right? Like, so just things that kind of make you raise an eyebrow. And you go, well, the company has, at this rate, right, they have between something like 1.5 and 2 years of runway. Not bad, right? Not terrible. But the question, I guess, when people become very negative is, well, then what, right? And as you start to get below 12 months of runway, then people really start getting worried about what's next. So I'm sure investors are asking you about things like that, right? How do you look at this, right? Is any company burning money? Are people just worried they're going to be insolvent? Or what's the, you know, are they just hoping that the rates come down and the Fed reverses? Or like, what's the way out of this?
Yeah, the way out of it, and I think we've been saying this for the last probably year and a half, more in some cases. I mean, you have to have operational discipline. And I think that's where many companies, unfortunately, right? I don't think that they necessarily did the requisite analysis before going and raising capital to understand what's the ROI on that capital, where they plan to invest it, and does it exceed sufficiently the cost of that capital? And I think in many cases, you saw companies that went out and raised money to go and spend on marketing and sales in hopes that it created the scale that they would be able to grow themselves out of this very expensive capital. And unfortunately, it didn't materialize. And that's where you're finding a lot of companies that are upside down. So from a capital standpoint, I think you now have this heightened level of, and sophistication is the wrong word, but maybe just, you know, savvy or street smarts, right? We've all kind of been around the block now and seen this industry go through a couple iterations and ups and downs, and realizing that hockey stick projection is probably not sound. Right. The building a business and investing in a business on the concept that the federal government's going to do something on a set timeline, probably not sound. Right. So it really comes back to, and this has been kind of funny, not funny in an interesting way, in that fundamentally, most of the venture community that we talk to, and this goes back now decades, it's really been about, are you investing in a product? Are you investing in a technology? Or are you investing in a team? And fundamentally, you're always investing in the team. And so this is where I think in the last year, we've seen heightened scrutiny on who's the team running the company? Have they had successful exits in the past? Have they built technology companies in the past, in or out of cannabis? Because if you can now have a couple data points, right, now all of a sudden you can begin to tell a story and you can begin to back a team and know that they'll be able to pivot and adjust and know that they'll be able to get very disciplined when the market environment requires that. And right now we're in a market environment that does. And so I think you see heightened scrutiny on the team. I think what was interesting coming out of some of the market feedback we've had on other processes is that the conversations also orient around what can you do outside of cannabis? And that I think is something that's not probably understood or talked enough about. So there's companies like, I'll throw out a couple private companies, but Anami Tech, I think is interesting. And they have a software platform that helps retailers and franchisees, whether you're franchising from another company or you're launching your own retail establishment, but to go through the process and sequence of making sure you've established all of your licenses, make sure you go through the process of the build out correctly. And so the software kind of takes you from a beginning to end to actually roll out a successful retail location. And it doesn't have to be cannabis. It's applicable across any industry.
Right.
There's another one called Seed. Get Seed is the website. And I think that one's incredibly interesting from a MarTech standpoint, because they're a digital display and kiosk technology business in a brick and mortar retail location. But their technology is such that they can actually understand who's, particularly when you check in to the retail store, you can actually understand who's shopping in my store at that time, and then change the shopping experience around that consumer in real time. I mean, I think it's incredible what some of this technology can do, but that has applications outside of cannabis as well. And so I think that's where, unfortunately, the capital markets, capital sources, they paint anything cannabis with a very broad brush. And it's unfair, but the fact of the matter is that's in many cases what's happening. And that's where you see companies that are probably discounted, unfairly so, right? When in reality, I think once we, and again, this is where I get back to my bullishness, I think we're going to start to see a capital markets recovery later this year. I'm hopeful that the second half of this year, we see more liquidity, we see more investment, we see more recovery. I think part of that will come from some of the attrition that we're going to see in the market. But I think at that point, you're going to start to see investment in companies that are able to demonstrate a real use case and a way of monetizing the technology, not just in cannabis, but outside of that. And I think to the extent that you can have exposure outside of a pure play cannabis market really helps support valuation. And honestly, at least right now, in many cases, expands the total addressable market for that technology significantly.
And let's just be clear. Are you saying we see a resurgence in demand for cannabis capital market activity, or are you saying in general across the markets by the back half of the year?
Both. I would say I don't know that we could see more demand for capital in the cannabis market right now. It feels like nearly everybody is out seeking capital at the moment, including even capital providers. I know some of the institutional guys are out trying to raise funds. And to their credit, many of them have said it's very, very difficult right now trying to raise capital, even for professional capital raisers. I couldn't imagine what it would be like for an operator to try and do this on their own. And we as agents and intermediaries would agree. It's very, very difficult. But I think broadly, you'll see more capital market activity in the back half of the year, as I think people become more bullish and more comfortable that we're hopefully facing some form of recovery. I think we'll all get to the point that we know where we're at in terms of recession, and that there is light at the end of the tunnel. And I think that will inherently make capital more bullish, and people will start putting that, you know, the risk trade back on and trying to figure out where can they find those returns. And the play for many of them historically has been new emerging technology that solves a real problem and addresses a large market. And I think a lot of the technology that we see coming out of the cannabis space, particularly where it has relevance outside of that, or stands to really change the tech landscape within cannabis, I think those are going to be very interesting opportunities. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say it. First of all, I hope you're right. I have the opposite view of you. I think we have a lot more pain to come, and I don't think we've felt it. I mean that broadly, generally speaking. And I think that extends to cannabis, but I hope you're right. Right. And I would take the other side of the argument is to say that, I kind of joked about the tail wagging the dog, but really, it is interesting to see when it comes to capital markets, public markets specifically, how things, how actions are incentivized and rewarded. Right. And I think Charlie Munger, says that, he thinks incentives are 90% of human behavior, and if anything, he's underestimating it, right? So the idea being that if you look at what's happening in the markets now, to your point, before it was all growth, growth, growth. So the more you could announce growth, the more the better it was for your company. And certainly we lived through that, right? And now it's the other way around, where companies are being rewarded for announcing cuts, right? Which is just a completely 180, you know, mindset shift. And cannabis companies that probably should have announced cuts years ago, like Canopy and Aurora, finally making those hard decisions after they've burned tons and tons of precious capital. So if you get people being more optimistic, right, which I hope is true, and people feel like, hey, it's not the end of the world, capital is going to start flowing again, there's going to be additional supply of capital from investors, then you take a lot of these scenarios like a Weed Maps or even let's say like an AIR, where companies everywhere right now, everyone's just focused on the downside. How are you going to repay your debt, you know, next year? How are you, what's going to happen when you run out of this runway in a year and a half, right? And so when you have fear like that, stocks trade down to, you know, 80 cents or something like that, or people are dumping the stock because it's better than nothing. But if you can turn the corner, even if you're still burning money, but people suddenly believe the capital markets are better and the money will be there, you can see significant appreciation in the equity value. In fact, I would say if you turn the corner, I would be surprised if you didn't see significant appreciation in names like that, right? So it's an interesting conversation to try to figure out is, you know, are the pendulum kind of spends a lot of time on the extremes and not so much time in the middle. You know, how extreme are we today, right? When it comes to the cannabis industry, I think we're pretty extreme. I think people are pretty focused on how likely is it these companies go bankrupt. And they don't care so much about if you get outsized growth. They care a lot more about safety, right? And if that dynamic changes, it could really reward investors who are putting fresh capital in today. But if it doesn't go that way, if it goes the other way, then there could just be more pain to come for these kind of beaten up names.
Agreed. But look, even a broken clock is right twice a day. Right. So if you sit here and say there's more pain to come, and I sit here and say that we're going to face a recovery, ultimately, we're both going to be right at some point.
Totally.
And I think and don't get me wrong. I mean, I do think that there is a significant amount of attrition and washout. And I think there's more headline risk in the next 3 to 6 months that we will see. I think in many ways, though, I feel like a lot of that is already baked into the prices. Right. And I think if something that's not been maybe as widely publicized, but you look at some of the lenders who have been recapping their own debt or extending maturities on their own facilities, or in many cases recapping at slightly higher rates, but maybe not necessarily market rates. And so I think what happens is they're trying to extend the runway for what they feel are otherwise good companies, recognizing that they've baked in to the cost of this capital a certain amount of risk of default. Now, the reality is, though, I think in many cases, they didn't necessarily understand exactly what the risk of default was from an industry basis when they underwrote some of those facilities 12 months, 24 months, 36 months ago. Sure. And so, you know, my heart doesn't exactly bleed for some of them when they're facing defaults because the cost of that capital priced that in, right? And I think their investors are certainly reaping the benefits of that high yield portfolio. But this is the downside. This is what can happen. Now, again, kudos to them for probably extending some of those maturities and recapping it. I'm sure it's not all entirely altruistic because they hope to recover that money down the track. But there again, if those companies can survive the next 6 months, 12 months, I think they're going to benefit from the recovery. And I think the lenders will ultimately look back and say, I think they did the right thing. And the companies, as long as they are able to demonstrate the right amount of diligence or discipline right now, I think that they have a high likelihood of making it through. But to your point, there will be a lot of good companies that just don't survive this, particularly if they're not able to deal with the reality that's at hand. And I think, you know, I took issue with the hopes of SAFE getting done in Q4 last year, because it felt to me like the probability of that was dramatically overstated by the market. And unfortunately, that just kept the bid-ask spread far too wide for a lot of good deals to get done. And so instead, now we're kicked the can down the road 3 months, and we're going to see more things getting done. I think you're going to see some notes getting sold too, for pennies on the dollar. And I think from our position, we've started to have conversations with your more traditional distressed type fund that is looking at this saying, we can be some patient capital and we can find some really good deals right now.
So let me ask you this. When it comes to asset values, you know, one thing we've talked a lot about over the last couple of months has been the idea that cannabis public markets have adjusted very abruptly, very painfully, especially after the up and down of SAFE, right? We felt that. But if you look at, you know, my bread and butter, my day today, which is commercial real estate and real estate in general, it's been a much slower process and there's been very little adjustment. I'll post a link to an interview summary from the OMERS CIO, who talks very interestingly about the difference between a hard reset and a soft reset, right? So, you know, to extend that, I would say that public markets had more of a hard reset, and certainly cannabis, you know, maybe the hardest of resets in terms of valuation on the public side. Real estate has been a very slow grinding reset, which arguably hasn't really hit, right? Where would you categorize private markets for cannabis? Are you seeing people say, look, I get it, I'm going to take a big write down to get capital in the door and you know, survive? Or like, is that bid-ask spread still pretty wide? Like, what's it like out there?
The bid-ask spread in most cases is still wider than I think it should be.
Okay.
Which I've been an entrepreneur before. I hate to say it this way. Everybody thinks that their baby's beautiful. I get it, right? But the reality is that in some cases, if you're not going to make it for the next 3 to 6 months, you need to deal with the reality at hand.
Sure.
And that has nothing to do with necessarily your business. That's just the reality of the markets today. And so I think you have a couple different flavors of capital that's sitting on the sidelines. You have the big institutional guys. And let's, since we're talking Canatech, let's kind of keep it on the VC side for a moment. I think you have VC and private equity, institutional, that I talked about, they're building these special purpose vehicles. I think they're waiting. They're waiting to see what happens. And given on a risk-adjusted basis, everything else that's out there, there's plenty of opportunities for them. There's some now, as we move down the spectrum, they have internal theses around investment theses on how to play the space. And in most cases, they even have internal advocates. And so we've had conversations with a number of them that are saying, how do we come and play this space? We're going to try and pick a spot. Where do we shoot our first shot? What's it going to look like? And in most cases, dare I say all cases, it's not plant-touching businesses. It's going to be the tech sector, right? Because of the MRR, because of the scalability, all the things we talked about. They get it, and their LPs are going to get it. And so for those LPs that opt into this sort of emerging industry thing, that they're going to want to do this. This is going to work for them. But even them, then it's a matter of how far along are they in developing their thesis. And in many cases, some of the most exciting institutional investors that we talk to, they face the challenge that our industry is still too small. And so they need to be able to go out and write a $50 million check. But a $50 million check is going to move the needle of the entire industry. And so it's not in their model to go and deploy, particularly on the private equity side, to go and deploy $5 million checks here and there. So then we move, you know, more towards kind of that venture community where maybe they're more accustomed to writing those smaller checks and having some add-ons, and they get the burn rate and they get all of that. Again, you've got these angels inside, these advocates that are developing the thesis and trying to build it out. And very quickly, it's been interesting to us to understand, how does their architecture work? What's their decision-making process? Because many times we'll get internal advocacy for an investment up through the hierarchy until it reaches the final stages where maybe you hit, could be a generational issue, could be any number of things, but the investment thesis hits a stop. Not that they don't want to pursue developing the thesis, but they aren't prepared to write a check yet. And so that's, again, where I come back to, I think in 6 months, you're going to see the shift. And that's where the bid-ask spread, to your point, will start to narrow, because I think the investors will be looking to put on more risk. They're going to get the concept of the technology play. There's a lot of themes to like here, particularly for those applications that either have the ability to play outside of cannabis, or like I'll use the example of a company called Complied. So they're interesting because in an ecosystem of technology that, you know, there's all of these POS systems, for example, that are creating customized solutions, or ERP systems that are creating customized solutions. What's to say Oracle or Salesforce couldn't move in to the space?
Sure.
And so there's an avenue here that if you create the right middleware, the APIs, to connect a mainstreamed enterprise solution into the cannabis-specific tech stack, now do you all of a sudden disrupt that entire tech stack? And I think you can bring in some big mainstream players and help to kind of mature the technology within the cannatech space. I think that's kind of an interesting play. So things like that, I think, will start to resonate. The challenges right now, and frankly, SVB didn't help this. But, sure. You know, that was a big wet blanket on the whole conversation too. But I think 6 months from now, I think that too will be in the rearview mirror enough that you're going to have investors starting to poke their heads out of their shells. And I say that because, you know, after a long time doing this, I think it's interesting to talk to people who don't spend their days kind of in this private equity investor community, mm-hmm. that there's the sense that the smart capital, they're risk takers. The reality is the smart capital, they're surprisingly risk averse, mm-hmm. even true in the venture community. And I think there's a reason why, you know, they make the bets the way they do, is that they look at things through a rather risk intolerant view. Mm-hmm. And there's enough headwinds and challenges to the industry, but I think it becomes that break-even point. There's also enough upside. There's also enough to like about this industry long-term. And so ultimately the deciding factor becomes, again, the patience of that capital and the timeline. So not too dissimilar from a retail investor, the institutional investors also have to take into consideration what's their timeline. Mm-hmm.
So let me ask you about two more things as we wrap up here. First is I want to come back to Green Check Verified. You know, very cool company, acts like a compliance layer, allows banks to bank cannabis related businesses, but do it compliantly, right? That's the whole idea behind it. And interesting because it's a new deposit source for the bank. And then they have their fingers in, you know, some of the ancillary pies that they're working on. So you guys helped on the raise. I looked at the round. I spent some time with the company in Miami at Benzinga in April 2022, so almost exactly a year ago. And it was probably the most compelling investment opportunity to me, you know, even though I had some money in and the raise was going to be at much higher than what I invested in. But, you know, the world started changing and I decided to back out of it, right? It's interesting to me, you guys completed the raise, what was it? I think late last year, 2022?
Correct.
And the thing that was interesting to me was you basically got the same pricing, right? You got pricing that was essentially the same, maybe a little bit less than what it was at the beginning of 22. So, which is a pretty amazing feat given everything that was happening at the world at that time. So just speak high level, what does that show you about the markets? Is that maybe a one-off? Could that be, every deal is different, but could that be replicated again for a company that's raising, you know, a couple million bucks and not a giant check? Like, what was it about that deal that made it happen? And does that speak to the cannabis marketplace today?
It does, but maybe not in the way you would think, right? I think that valuation in no small part was absolutely due to the executive team and the product that they've built and the roadmap they've laid out and the story that they've told. And as you said, it's incredibly compelling to hear it, but without a counterparty, it doesn't matter, right? And so that's where I think Mendon Venture Partners, who leaned in as the lead on the round, you know, they also saw it the way you and I did, which is this is a mission critical solution to solving probably the biggest issue that our industry faces. And the reality is that whatever milestone you put on the table, SAFE or interstate or whatever it might be, those all actually inure to the benefit of companies like a green check, right? Because it only means there's going to be more deposit dollars. There's going to be more transactions.
Right.
And it's not a technology that is easily replicated or created outside of cannabis and then repurposed inside. And so they saw it, they got it. And I think there again, they would fall in my mind under that sort of patient capital concept. So the interesting thing is they look at this as a fintech play, mm-hmm. right? It's not a cannabis business. It's a fintech business. It's a regtech business. And that's many times the conversation that we're trying to have, which is this is not necessarily a cannabis business. This is a business that just happens to participate in an industry that's growing at a double-digit CAGR. It's a fintech company or it's a martech company, right? And I think that's a very purposeful distinction that we manage when we go to market.
Interesting. And talking about capital raising, one thing that we didn't talk about last episode that would be good for us to chat about is, you know, TerrAscend making news, the idea of uplisting to the TSX, you know, maybe not a full uplisting, right? Not the big boy NASDAQ, but still not bad, right? I mean, I've talked to institutional investors who said, yeah, you know, if we had appetite for this, we could buy on the TSX, right? We would not buy on OTC or the CSE, but we would buy on the TSX. What's your thought on this? Would this change something for the industry? And if so, what would it change?
Yeah, you're right. It's not bad. It's better than a poke in the eye. But is it going to change everything overnight? No. And I think it may have been a Freudian slip on your part, but you said if we were interested in this, yes, we could do it. I think that's unfortunately going to be the case for a lot of investors.
To be clear, that was his position. Like if we were if we had any appetite to touch these companies that we have no interest in, we could do it.
That's exactly what I'm saying. I don't think it changes the underlying investment thesis. It does create more access, sure. And I think it also, you know, like so many, I think, headlines that came out over the last 12 months, many of them political here in the US. And the debate was, does this meaningfully move the needle? No, probably not. But it does create some form of momentum. It does further the conversation. And I think something like that, you know, an uplisting or even some sort of partial, I think that all helps. And certainly there is some tranche of investors that have a thesis on the industry, and that is for them the gating item. You'll see some influx of capital, but it's not going to be the silver bullet that everybody hoped SAFE would be, which SAFE wouldn't have been the silver bullet either. You know, I don't think this will be the silver bullet, but it's a positive event, and I think we should all appreciate it, but I don't see it meaningfully moving the needle in my world all that much.
Yeah, and look, if TerrAscend figures this out, and I hope they do, then I'm sure every other MSO will copy it, right? And just copy the structure and apply it. I don't see why they wouldn't, right? But until then, I think they're just going to sit and wait because, you know, what's the rush, right? You know, another, going back to our previous point, like there are, for example, Canatech companies on the NASDAQ, right? So it's not like the market has no access to cannabis companies. It has some access to cannabis companies. The difference was before the OTC listed companies were actually making money, right? And that is what's changed, is that the OTC ones are almost every single one of them no longer making money. So you can uplist, you can even go all the way to the NASDAQ, you have more access to capital, more access to investors, and maybe there's more appetite to fund losses, right? That could be the reality, but it doesn't necessarily help them generate better profits. Now, if the access to capital increases share price and you can refinance out some of your debt, right? Or even alleviate some of your bankruptcy concerns, then that could be beneficial. But at the end of the day, you do need a sustainable business model in order to get there.
100%. I was going to add, I don't think that you're going to see uplisting occur in a vacuum, right? I think it's going to be part of a broader conversation, and it may not be completely coincidental in that it all happens within, you know, a 1 month period, but I think you'll see a sequence of events where you're going to see maybe some form of tax reform, maybe some form of bankruptcy reform, maybe some form of regulatory oversight reform. And I think as part of that, you'll start to see this appetite for uplisting kind of increase. And I think then maybe you see some of that. And all of those things contribute to potentially bringing down the cost of capital, helping the companies become more profitable. And then to your point, then they become real companies and they become a real investable opportunity. Then I think it makes sense. To do it in a vacuum, I think the probability of uplisting goes down dramatically. And I think the usefulness of it really isn't there.
Interesting. Okay, Colin, to close it out, I would love to chat with you about mergers and acquisitions. So before we started, you said you've got some things cooking, you can't really talk about it. But just broadly speaking, right, how's M&A looking in the business right now? We've heard, you know, from different people that the trouble is, you know, it's tough to find companies to put together. You know, people don't agree or see eye to eye on valuation. You know, people don't want to inherit other people's problems. Talk to me about what's going on out there and what are M&A deals, what type of deals are likely to see success in this environment?
Yeah, so there's a couple themes that I think are important for everybody to understand if they're facing the M&A markets right now. Deals tend to be highly structured. So we're seeing a lot of earnouts, we're seeing seller notes, we're seeing valuations really focused on relative valuation, particularly in the case where there really isn't a lot of cash changing hands. And the fact of the matter is, there isn't a lot of cash changing hands, mm-hmm. right? And so in many cases, these are paper mergers. And so, you know, the TIBCO Gold Flora merger got a lot of press here recently. That one's interesting. TIBCO's got a lot of cash on their balance sheet, and that very well could make that work. We'll have to see how it plays out. Execution is always the deciding factor of any M&A transaction. Dare I say, most, if not all of them, look really good on paper. And then it comes down to can the team actually pull it off? And I don't know those teams well enough to say, but...
Let me jump in because I don't think we've ever actually talked about that, the Gold Flora parent company merger. Everyone knows parent company, right? People have looked at it many times. I've looked at it before, never bought a share of it. But I'm actually, funny enough, an investor in Gold Flora, right? And I think I'm the only one I know who's an investor in Gold Flora. And, you know, people at online, at least, were a little peeved because like, hey, why are we giving up 51% of our company to Gold Flora? But as a Gold Flora investor, I was like, yeah, the parent company has, I can't remember the number now, right? But whatever it is in cash, but they're burning $20 million a quarter, right? They have all these outstanding accounts payable. So when you actually look at how much they're burning and how long this deal is going to take, I don't know how much cash is actually going to be left at the end of the day, right? So even in a deal where, you know, you're doing it for the cash, right? And from the Gold Flora side, at least in my mind, there's a question of, hey, how much cash is going to be left once the deal actually closes?
Well, and that's the other challenge, right? Is that more so in this industry than most any others, they take a long time to get done.
Yeah.
And I mean, look at the Columbia Care deal, right? I mean, it's still not done. And I'm not going to handicap whether or not that does get done and when. Sure. And so I think the Gold Flora one, for all of the modeling and everything that went into that, I'm sure, again, I don't know the inside workings of that one, and I'm not going to opine on it, but you know, I'm sure it all made sense to get a lot of really smart people to sign off on it and say, let's do it. It's not a slam dunk, right? And I think that's something that anybody facing the M&A markets right now needs to understand, is that, you know, the old adage, I'm sure it's true in your business too, time kills all deals.
Yep.
And particularly in this industry, it is not on our sides. And so you need to be thoughtful, you need to be prudent, but you also need to be expeditious with executing any of these deals.
Totally.
And so I think that's a piece of it. I think the relative valuation is interesting. I think that's one way of sort of closing that bid ask spread, because it's not a matter of hard values. But you look at some of the public companies that have north of 55%. I think it's Tilray has north of 70% of the assets on their balance sheet are intangibles. I mean, those, I think we're going to see a big write down there, but for all of the debt covenants that are precluding companies from writing their balance sheet in those respects, because they'd violate all of these triggers and have, you know, an issue with their lenders. Mm-hmm. So I think there is, the M&A markets are still open, particularly in the case, because, you know, there's an argument to be made, the top end of the M&A market, when we're talking about multi-billion dollar deals, that market can go to zero. That market can close for periods of time. The middle market, the lower middle market, really where the entire cannabis industry exists, that market never closes. Hmm. There's always some form of deal to be had, because the companies are bite sizes relative to, you know, the grand scheme of things.
Sure.
And so I think that there's enough opportunities that we'll see deals get done. There is more of a distressed element to some of these deals, just by the nature of the cash burn and the runway that many of them are facing. And that's where I think you'll find good companies finding creative solutions to difficult times, and business owners who are so fixated on, you know, manifesting the vision of what they originally set out when they created their business and being unwilling to adjust, I think they're going to have a hard go of it. But I think the ones that can be practical and understand the reality of the situation in the markets we're in and approach it head on, I think they're going to survive. And I think you'll see some good companies come through in a different form, but they'll come through.
Got it. Colin, now I'm going to give you the last word here as we sign off. What would you like to leave the listeners with?
Every industry has its challenges. I think we're such an incredible opportunity to be all involved and spending time talking about and thinking about this industry as it's coming out of prohibition. And I think it's so exciting. I think it has a role to play in any retail investor's portfolio and in institutional investor's portfolio. I think you just need to be thoughtful about where you take your shot. And I think you need to look for folks that are spending time in the industry thinking about it. And if we can be helpful, we'd love to do that.
Okay. And I'll link your information at the bottom. Colin, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you, everybody, for listening. CINpodcast@gmail.com. Until next time.
This podcast is a general communication and entertainment being provided for informational purposes only. It is educational in nature and not designed to be a recommendation for any specific investment product, strategy, plan, feature, or other purposes. Any examples used in this podcast are generic, hypothetical, and for entertainment purposes only. None of Cannabis Investing Network or its affiliates are suggesting that the listener or any other person take a specific course of action or any action at all. Communications such as this are not impartial and are provided in connection with advertising and marketing of products and services. Prior to making any investment or financial decisions, an investor should seek individualized advice from a personal financial, legal, tax, and other professional advisor that take into account all of the particular facts and circumstances for an investor's own situation. By listening to this communication, you agree with the intended purpose described earlier. Opinions and statements of financial market trends that are based on current market conditions constitute our judgment and are subject to change without notice. We believe the information provided here is reliable, but should not be assumed to be accurate or complete. The views and strategies described may not be suitable for all investors.